Coming up, got S. Barahini talking about everything that happened this weekend in the NBA, looking ahead to the NBA playoffs and the play-in happening this week. Finally, best time of the year. I mean, we got playoffs coming up. We got the play-in. We got the draft. Doesn't get better than this in the NBA. And then later in the show, I got Musa Diabate from the Charlotte Hornets joining me for a conversation, previewing the play-in for the Hornets, talking about his game and his journey. Really fun podcast coming up right now. The NBA regular season is over. Finally, it's time for the playoffs to discuss it all. S. Barahini. S., how are you doing?
Man, I'm living the dream. We're finally here. Playoff basketball is here. And I can't wait because, yeah, this should be a really good postseason. I really do think we're in for like an awesome playoff run, even though the last month has been what I would best describe as uneven for the regular season. But the playoffs have been good, or it will be good. I'm very excited for it.
I think the MVP race is very fun now. The stretch got some great matchups between those top players. There's a ton of tanking, obviously. Like a third of the league, the games are unwatchable or not worth watching. But I think, I hope, I pray, we are setting up for an epic postseason. And so I want to start off with the Western Conference with some of the stuff that we saw on Sunday, including the Spurs deciding not to play Victor Wembanyama. They played some of their guys, so they were competing in a sense again for a chance to knock out the Nuggets from the three spot. The Spurs could have knocked the Nuggets to the four seed if they fully played to win, would have ended up with a bracket not seeing Denver or Oklahoma City until the Western Conference Finals. Did the Spurs make the right choice, though, resting some of their guys against Denver?
I mean, they didn't really even rest. It was just Wemby and Luke Kornet that didn't play.
Wemby's the big one, and Kornet's a big one, too. He's their backup.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. I mean, like, Plumlee minutes aren't going to help you win basketball games, so no doubt. I agree. But, like, De'Aaron Fox played 33 minutes. Steph Castle played 30 minutes. You would think that the Nikola Jokic basically playing 20 minutes in that game wouldn't be enough to beat the rest of the Spurs supporting cast, but David the Spurs Roddy. Were actually trying there. Big body Roddy. Raptors 905 legend David Roddy, by the way. He was incredible. But also, like, the Spurs were actually trying in this game. You could see it from the lineups that they were throwing out there in the fourth quarter. They just didn't have enough for the Nuggets nucleus. And I think the Nuggets had built up a decent enough lead to keep it comfortable. I will say, though, all of this talk about path, the easy path forward, et cetera, et cetera. I don't like tempting the basketball gods. I'm not going to lie to you. It's a dangerous and slippery slope to play with because ultimately you have to play who's in front of you. And the Spurs won, what did they win? 62 games this season. I think if you win 62 games, you have a guy who potentially could be the youngest defensive player of the year ever, going to be one of the youngest MVP, top three MVP vote getters ever. I just think it's, you have to be confident in your team. And the Spurs should be very confident in the fact that no matter if it's the Nuggets, if it's the Lakers, if it's the Thunder in front of them, they should be able to beat anybody. You've won 62 games for a reason. Why tempt the basketball gods, KOC? Why do that?
I'm right there with you, S. I wish we disagreed on this, but ultimately, I look at it like this. This is how I look at it. To be the best, you got to beat the best. And could it be any other way for Victor Wembanyama in his first NBA postseason where he's now going to get through a gauntlet potentially to get all the way to the NBA Finals, where now you got to get through Jokic in the second round. You got to get through Oklahoma City and SGA in the Western Conference Finals. It feels like destiny that for Victor Wembanyama, this is the way it has to be, win or lose, going against the best.
I will also say from the Nuggets perspective, like they had a chance to quote unquote be on the easier side. They now face the Timberwolves in round one versus they would have faced, you know, the Rockets in the first round if they lost this game. I also think from their perspective, they should be happy with this result. I know the Timberwolves are a harder matchup and they now have, quote unquote, the harder path forward because they would play the Spurs in the second round and then, you know, obviously likely the Oklahoma City Thunder in the conference finals if they make it there. But there was so much talk when the Nuggets won the championship about how easy their path was. Can you imagine that locker room right now, given what they had heard about their title and how easy it was to get there? You play the 8th seed in the NBA Finals in the Miami Heat, and now you've been given the gauntlet. And I think that's an awesome test for a Nuggets team that I really do believe can win the NBA title. They've been playing some awesome basketball down the stretch. They finished the year off on a 12-game winning streak. I think they should be more than okay with this path forward for them.
I mean, I ultimately, I'd say from a fan perspective, this is by far the most entertaining possible outcome because of this potential path we're talking about in the second round and the conference finals, but also just the first round. We get Nuggets Wolves again, the third time in 4 years. These have been some really good matchups in both the playoffs and in the regular season over the years. In 2023, they split the season series, and the Nuggets won in the won 4-1 in the playoffs. In 2024, they split the season series again. Wolves won that series 4-3. And then in 2025, Wolves went 4-0 against Denver. And then this year, the Nuggets went 3-1 against the Wolves. And so I'm fired up for what should be, hopefully, a very healthy Anthony Edwards, what's looking like a very healthy Nuggets team. This has the makings of potentially, once again, another epic Denver Nuggets-Minnesota Timberwolves series.
Yeah, it's genuinely a rivalry in the NBA. In an era where we don't see too many rivalries just because of how much player movement there is, both of these rosters are basically the same from the last time that they played each other. Of course, there's some role players and ancillary guys that are new to the table, but for the most part, it's Nikola Jokic versus Rudy Gobert and Julius Randle, and it's Anthony Edwards against Jamal Murray, and of course, Jaden McDaniels and all those guys are still there from that playoff series. And so you look at a matchup that I think the Wolves look at the Nuggets and say, we have a mental edge over them. And you look at the Nuggets and what they have developed this season, how they've comfortably, truthfully beat the Wolves in the regular season. They probably think they have a mental edge over Minnesota. I also think Minnesota has been a little bit uneven here to finish out the year, given the Anthony Edwards injury, given the fact that McDaniels was also out for a little bit with his injury. I wonder, they're not going into this series in peak form. They're not going into the series at their best. The Nuggets, meanwhile, on the other hand, are going into the series playing some of their best basketball. And also, you know, I mean, we're going to talk about this a little bit more, but like Aaron Gordon is the key to everything for them. You know, as much as Jokic is the MVP and Jamal Murray has had an all-star level season, nothing is complete on this Nuggets team without Aaron Gordon. This season, they are 27-9 when Gordon plays. They're 27-19 when he doesn't play. They are a completely different team when he is on and off the floor. And I think he plays a major factor in this Timberwolves series too. Just his level of shot making, how he completes the three-man action between Jokic, Murray, and himself. And if he is fully healthy, and given where the Nuggets are at in terms of them being in peak form, I wonder if this won't be as competitive of a series as we think it will be. Like the rivalry is there. You know, the history of it, if you will, is there, and the matchup is relatively similar to the last time these two played in playoffs. But the Nuggets are just playing better basketball than the Timberwolves right now.
They definitely are. I mean, the way they closed the season, this team, for the most part, the entire year until, what, the last 2 or 3 weeks, they weren't healthy at all. I mean, I remember earlier in the year, like back in October or early November, whenever it was before Aaron Gordon got hurt the first time, saying, oh my God, they're defense looks great, that finally Jokic has a backup for when he's off the floor, and Valanciunas, and even Valanciunas got hurt at one point. I mean, everybody was out at one point for this Nuggets team, and they never really got it right. And Jokic himself, even after he came back from his hyperextended knee, wasn't quite his peak self on the defensive end of the floor either. It's in part why I'm going to have him third on my MVP ballot and not first or second, because he wasn't quite the same level he was in his three MVP seasons. But at this point, the last 2-3 weeks, this team could have won 60 plus games or been right up there with Oklahoma City and San Antonio, winning 60, 64, 63, 62 games. That's how special they've been, in part.
Yeah.
Because as you said, Aaron Gordon, what he unlocks defensively with his size as a help defender, as an on-ball stopper, and then offensively, I had him on a podcast like 3 weeks ago talking about his improvements as a shooter. The dude is elite as a spot-up guy at this point. It's unbelievable what he's turned into.
We were actually, so I covered the Toronto Raptors, as we will probably get into it here in a little bit, but I was looking at some outlier shooting development because I'm trying to project forward with Scotty Barnes, and Scotty has obviously taken over 1,000 threes throughout his career, but he's shooting about 30% on them. What are some guys that are similar to that, that in their first 1,000 to 1,500 attempts were only about a 30 to 32% shooter? The guy that keeps jumping out is Aaron Gordon, because he was not that good of a shooter, and now he's turned himself into like a marksman. He is one of the best off-ball players in the NBA. He ranks in the like 98th percentile as a spot-up player, not just because of his shooting ability, but because of his cutting, his decision-making on the floor, off of the ball. Again, he completes that two-man action with Jokic and Murray in a way that genuinely makes the Nuggets unstoppable. They are, and this is to the continuity point, I actually think both of these teams have a lot of continuity, right? We've seen the Wolves go through a couple of different iterations of this thing, but they kind of know what they are as a nucleus. The same thing applies to the Nuggets, even though you plug and play guys like Cam Johnson and Peyton Watson. But the Nuggets are a machine offensively, and they proved that this season. They were the number one offense in the league for a reason. They're a buzzsaw. And so I'm curious whether stepping up against this Timberwolves team that has Rudy Gobert, who probably, maybe, potentially ends up on a Defensive Player of the Year ballot, and the point of attack defenders that we've seen really make Jamal Murray struggle. How is this series going to shake out? I wouldn't be surprised if the Wolves win, but I just, given where they are in terms of their form, I'd lean Denver, you know?
I definitely lean Denver as well. And I think the other aspect I just want to hit on with the series as well, and why I'm so happy the bracket fell the way it did, and you mentioned it, and people talked about how quote-unquote easy the path was for the Nuggets when they won the title the first time around, and now it's maximum difficulty. Nikola Jokic is one of the greatest players that we'll ever see in our entire lives. He's a three-time MVP. He's a one-time champion. And when you look at the greatest players of all time, the 10 or 12 greatest players, all of them have multiple titles, whether it's, you know, the extremes, Bill Russell with 11, Jordan and Kareem with 6, Magic and Duncan and Kobe with 5, LeBron's got 4, Shaq's got 4, Larry Bird's got 3, Wilt's got 2. Jokic has to get his second one to reach that level when we talk about the all-time greatest players in the history of basketball. And no better test than to do it with this gauntlet the Nuggets are going to have to go through in the Western Conference with Minnesota, their longtime rival, then potentially the Spurs, and then potentially the Thunder, just to get to the NBA Finals. It's on a silver platter for Jokic right now to become one of the 5 to 10 greatest players in NBA history, winning his second.
They are also the healthiest they've ever been. Like, Jamal Murray is the healthiest he's ever been in a playoff series. Aaron Gordon is luckily healthy now, and he's looked really good since he's come back from that hamstring injury. We'll see what happens with Peyton Watson. He's a big and important part to this whole piece. Might end up on a most improved ballot, but just his ability to create off the bench for them, be another, you know, defender and weak side helper in their defensive scheme. But overall, I just think this is the healthiest the Nuggets have been. And you mentioned this earlier about them not really winning. What did they win, like 52 or 53 games, something along the lines of that? They could have easily won 60 this year. If they were healthy, they 100% would have been one of the 60-win teams. They would have been right there neck and neck with the Thunder and with the Spurs. That's how talented of a group this is. I really believe in them. This might be jumping the gun here, but I would pick them. I actually think they are the team that I would pick to win the NBA championship right now, given where OKC is. I know it's a hot take. It feels like a hot take, but every time I've watched the Nuggets this season at full strength, I just feel like it's a different gear than what they've been in the past. Everything feels complete to me. And I know the defensive struggles are valid, but having Gordon and Peyton Watson are very important for this group. If those guys are healthy, I do think they can win an NBA championship.
They're a much better defensive team with those guys than they are without
absolutely.
Them. And they have Gordon right now. You talk about their health, a team that is not healthy, and we don't even know the status of some of their guys entering the week right now. The Lakers. Luka is somewhere in Spain getting injections in his hamstring right now, or whatever type of treatment he's getting there. And Austin Reeves is recovering from a lower body injury as well. Do the Lakers have any chance against the Rockets if Reeves and Luka both don't play?
Yes. I actually do think they have a chance.
Wow.
So the Rockets
What's
have,
the case? And tell me the case, S.
I'll pitch the case for you right now, okay? So we've seen the Rockets in fourth quarters absolutely collapse, right? We've seen the clutch issues that the Rockets have had. We've seen the half-court offense issues that we thought Kevin Durant would alleviate still persist for this Rockets team this season. It's been a big issue for them all year. We've seen multiple times their just execution on that end has not been crisp. It's an over-reliance on Kevin Durant and his shot-making. And while KD has had an incredible season, I do wonder if there is a sort of kryptonite situation with this Lakers team, because basically the Rockets see more zone than anybody other than the Pistons and the Thunder. And they are 26th in terms of zone efficiency. They do not score against the zone well at all. And of course, that's part of it. Part of it is the shooting. You know, Amen Thompson, not that great of a shooter. Şengün, inconsistent shooter. Tari Eason, inconsistent shooter or non-shooter at times. So their lack of shooting really makes them susceptible to zone defenses. And on the other side, the Lakers have found themselves an identity with their zone defense. J.J. Redick has unlocked a lot for this team because of how much zone they've played. I think it's enabled LeBron James to be a much better defender at his age. Marcus Smart to kind of play that free safety position for them and make gambles and take risks that kind of work well. I think it's also helped DeAndre Ayton play simplified basketball on defense. And so I wonder if there's a world where the Lakers can just extend this series through the use of their zone to the point where Luka might come back. I don't think Austin Reeves will come back. I think he's out for longer, but maybe Luka comes back in game 5 or game 6 of this series. And it's 2-2 or 3-2 for either side. And now you have an opportunity to win this series. So that's my pitch for the Lakers beating the Rockets in an upset.
I think it's quite a strong pitch. I do think at some point they're going to have to need Luka in the series. And we'll see what's reported throughout the week. But it is worth at least noting that according to a Slovenian news outlet, Ekipa, Doncic is expected to rejoin the Lakers midweek this week and be ready for a word that translates to the second half. I would assume second half meaning the playoffs. So Ekipa is reporting that he spent time in Spain, and then he saw his daughters at one point, and then he's going back for more treatment before he returns to Los Angeles. So just something, a little news note, just to keep in mind from overseas, that Luka is expected to be back in Los Angeles this week, possibly ready for the postseason, which would be quite a fast recovery. You almost wonder as if maybe the Lakers would be better off holding him out game one, giving him a little bit of, of extra time to rest and bring him back if necessary. Because what if you're up 2-0, right? Like, it's possible. You could be up 2-0, and maybe we don't want to rush him back. Let's wait until round two, which could give you some time off before then.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if the Lakers make this a more interesting series than people are thinking, because I think they have the shooting with Rui Hachimura and Luke Kennard, who I hope is able to shoot the ball in this series. But overall, I think they have the offensive firepower. I think it will be how much LeBron can assert himself in this series, how healthy and just all time he looks. And then on the other side, can Kevin Durant do the same for the Rockets? It will be one-on-one in the sense of both of these all-time greats, which should be fun in its own way. Both of these all-time greats that we've seen go head-to-head in multiple playoff series in the past, and how they're able to assert their dominance over their teams, but also over how the other team counteracts it. I think that comes down to the zone defense. I really do think it comes down to the zone defense and whether the Lakers can make things hard on Houston and especially Kevin Durant. So
with the play-in, we're going to see Clippers versus Warriors, Suns versus Blazers. Which of those four play-in teams should be feared the most?
It's interesting because I probably would have said the Clippers maybe like a month ago. Because I really like this style that they've developed with Darius Garland and Mathurin at the helm. They just have a lot more pop offensively. They play in transition more often. And of course, Kawhi Leonard might end up on a first team All NBA ballot. Like that's how good he's been. But I think the lack of size is really going to hurt them against any playoff matchup. It might not hurt them against the Warriors because the Warriors have their own size issues, but if you're going up against the Spurs or the Thunder, not having Zubats, not even honestly not having Yannick Niederkotterhauser, who has been pretty good for them, him being out this season is going to hurt their ability to guard in certain matchups. I don't think it's the Clippers. I would have picked the Clippers before. I feel like it's Portland.
Ooh,
I feel like it's Portland.
I like this. I like
so, it. So the Blazers are a really feisty defensive group, and they have a lot of wing defense. Donovan Clingan is one of the best paint protectors this season. The combination of Drew Holiday and Tumani Kamara, and you know, on the wings, they can throw out different wing defenders like Matisse Thybulle. I just think they have a lot of size and versatility defensively that makes them at least annoying to try and play in a seven-game series. And I don't know if they have – I'll say this right now. I don't think they have what it takes to upset the Thunder or the Spurs, but can they at least push them to five, maybe six games? I wouldn't rule it out. I just think the level of defense that they have could make things interesting in a series compared to any of the other West play-in teams.
They get the number three defensive rating in basketball since the All-Star break. They're tough. They're feisty. As you said, they have a ton of wings. They got Kling in the back. They're a really tough, tough team. And I think if they end up, you know, making it to become the seventh seed or the eighth seed, they're going to be at least a tough out, even if it ends up being a sweep. I was going to say the Blazers too. I don't think you can underrate the Clippers, you know, just because of what heights Kawhi Leonard can reach. That makes him automatically tough, and they have the other guys there as well. I don't think it's the Warriors. I'd go as far to say that the Warriors should try to lose, and there's been reporting out of Golden State that we're going to see minutes limits for Stephen Curry and other guys in that roster.
Oh, they're trying to lose.
They better try to lose, because if they lose, they end up with the number 11 odds. I mean, yeah, come on. Number 11 is what got number one last year. So I want those odds if I'm the Warriors, instead of getting spanked in the first round. If you happen to get there against Oklahoma City, it would be sad to see Steph go out this year like that.
It's funny you say this, because sneakily, and my co-host Dave mentioned this on the podcast yesterday, the Blazers have an incentive to lose because their pick is lottery protected and it goes to the Chicago Bulls. And so would you rather get smoked by the Spurs or Thunder, or would you rather have a, I don't know, 1% chance, whatever it is, at AJ DeBonta or Darren Peterson or whoever? I don't know. It's intriguing. It's something to think about.
It is. I mean, and I think the flip side of it is with the Warriors and Clippers is, can you imagine if the Clippers lose? Because then Oklahoma City would end up with the number 11 odds, 9.4% at top four, 2% at number one if the Warriors win that game.
God, it'd be insane, man. It's insane. I can't even imagine it. They already are in a position to just dominate the rest of this decade, and to add another top five pick would be absurd.
They don't even need one, though. They could still find a really good player with the pick wherever it ends up in the 10 to 15 range. Well, here's another question about that for you. What's more likely? Clippers lose the play-in, their pick moves into the top four and goes to OKC, or Clippers win two in the play-in, get the eight seed, and then beat OKC in round one?
Wow, definitely the lottery pick. 100% the lottery pick.
which is probably like a, if you look at it, what a 9% chance of happening versus it's less than 9%. It's for sure.
Absolutely is less than 9%. Also, it's funny because there's a, you know, a Clippers incentive here for the Pacers side of things, because like they might still end up with a lottery pick given the odds for them. I don't know. The draft lottery, I know we're still a way away, but that's going to be a very entertaining night in basketball, no question.
Oh, I cannot wait. That's one of my favorite nights of the entire calendar year. And we'll be right back after this break. Move on to the Eastern Conference here, as your Raptors, the number five seed in the East, baby. Bill Simmons has to pay up to Kendrick Perkins now. I'm sure you guys in Toronto are talking about that. So tell me this, S. If the Raptors beat the Cavaliers, what's the story of the series? How did it happen?
Wow. If they do that, it's because they've had an incredible shooting series. An incredible shooting series for a team that is not that good of a shooting team. It is Jacoby Walter knocked down 4 threes a game, and he's been a really good shooter for them. Post All-Star break, he's shooting like 43%. It's you know, guys like Jamal Shedd and Emmanuel Quickley punching up and shooting well. It's Mamu chipping in with 12 points and a couple of threes. Really, I think the offense is going to be the big question here. If the Raptors win, it'll be because they matched what the Cavaliers can give you on any given night offensively. The firepower of Donovan Mitchell and James Harden. Of course, there's also the other side of it, which is how do they contain that firepower and how do they guard those two guys, which I think is a valid question moving forward. But ultimately, yeah, it's can they keep up offensively? Can Scottie Barnes and Brandon Ingram create enough advantages for them in order to sustain themselves in the half court? It's funny because the Raptors this season, for the first time in Darko Arjakovic's time as head coach, have had a top 10 half court offense. They actually found a way to win in the half court. And I'm really curious to see whether that translates to postseason basketball, because of course, postseason basketball is a lot of half court hoops.
Toronto is 3-0 versus the Cavaliers this season. They haven't played them since November, which feels like a different season. I mean, just different teams, different everything at that point of the year. You're not putting anything at all into that, or is there anything to pull from those games?
I can't put anything into those games. I watched them. I did a film breakdown last night after the game, and after we got confirmed it's going to be Raptors-Cavs. And the way that the Raptors were hunting out Lonzo Ball and DeAndre Hunter and putting them in actions, it's very obvious that this is a very different Cavs team now. Very different Cavs team with Keon Ellis and Dennis Schroeder, two guys that you can't hunt out as much. And look, above that, James Harden has done very well against the Raptors in the past. They've only played in one playoff series against him in 2022 when he was a member of the Philadelphia 76ers. He didn't even have that good of a shooting series, but he absolutely carved up the Raptors' pick and roll defense. And that was a very different Raptors team. You know, it had Pascal Siakam and Jakob Poeltl and Fred VanVleet and all those guys. Very different team. But some of the same issues persist here, in the sense that how are you going to contain a pick and roll of James Harden and Evan Mobley, of James Harden and Jared Allen, and then on the other side, worry about Donovan Mitchell? It's just a lot to contain. And so there's going to be a lot of pressure on Scottie Barnes defensively, a lot of pressure on Colin Murray-Boyles defensively, and if Jakob Poeltl can be healthy, because I think he's a big factor in this series as well.
I don't love Toronto's chances, unfortunately. I just don't love their chances. I think they're a tough team, but Cleveland's just, they're a tough team too. They have a lot of bodies on defense, obviously, with Mobley and Allen in the front court and a ton of wings, Dean Wade, Max Strus, Sam Merrill. I mean, they're so loaded and versatile and can play different types of lineup combinations, never mind Harden and Mitchell in the backcourt as your creators, and Schroeder and Keon Ellis. They're just a deep, versatile team. I really like this Cavs roster. I think, you know, Kobe Altman and their GM did great work at the deadline putting this together and swapping out some of those pieces that were a liability to their championship hopes. And I mean, I look at them and then I look at what the Hawks decided to do in game 82, and they rested their starters effectively they chose a first-round series against the Knicks instead of the Cavaliers. I think that's the right choice for Atlanta to make, even though they lost that game last week against the Knicks. It was a really, really competitive game. I think they can beat that team in the series. I like the way they played against the Knicks. I think that's going to be a really tough first-round series for New York being the favorite. Do you think the Hawks made the right choice in going this route?
Yeah, I do. I think also Knicks fans are probably a little less happy right now because they would have preferred the Raptors too. I think Knicks fans know exactly why the Hawks can be trouble for the Knicks well, specifically for Jalen Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns, because so much of what the Hawks do on offense, especially in the half court, is on these timely cuts. And so you have to be really, really on point when it comes to your rotations. And that's going to put pressure on Jalen Brunson. That's going to put pressure on Karl Anthony Towns to be in the right spots, in the right moments. Jalen Johnson being this battering ram for the Hawks offense, running in transition. It's going to put a lot of pressure on the Knicks transition defense to be at its best too. And then on the other side, I think the Hawks being this switch heavy, loaded with wings, with Dyson Daniels and of course Johnson himself, but Onyeka Okongwu and Nikhil Alexander Walker, they are so comfortable switching 1 through 5, and that's the exact type of defense that the Knicks struggle against, particularly Karl Anthony Towns.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, plus they can pull Cat out with Onyeka Okongwu. He is such a skilled center with his ability to shoot that he's developed over this past year. At this point for Atlanta, they just present a lot of issues now. And I'm not making my official picks for the series yet. I'm going to dive deeper over the course of the week. But my gut feeling says this one is going to be the most competitive series in the first round of the Eastern Conference. I don't really see, personally, a competitive series between the play-in teams versus the Pistons, or definitely not the Celtics against the Sixers without Embiid now, or against the Magic. Maybe the Hornets can be competitive against the Pistons, but for the Magic, oh my God, how do you lose? How do you lose on Sunday against Boston? Boston played nobody, and the Magic played all their guys, and yet something weird happened. Desmond Bane played only the first quarter, 5-6 minutes, and then he got pulled. And they did that so they could get him to 82 games played on the season. And then they brought him back in the fourth quarter because they're like, oh, damn, we need our guys to win this game. And they lose anyway. And yet this is another sign that we've seen all year from the Magic, a lack of preparation, a lack of connectiveness. And then in this final game that they got to win to get a home game in the play-in, all the things they did indicate that they looked past the Celtics as an opponent, thinking they'd be handed the win. And instead, you got career-high 30 for Baylor Shireman, career-high 27 for Ron Harper Jr., career-high 27, including the go-ahead three-pointer in the final moments by Luka Garza. That's what you got, Orlando. I'd say it's over for this team.
Yeah, actually, I was going to say that. Can we do a unison blow it up? I feel like this is, you know, apt for you. It would be great to create a new version of the meme. Just blow it up, right? Let's do it on three. Blow it up. Exactly. Yeah, there we go. I've always wanted to do that. That's awesome. Okay. I agree with you with Orlando. It was a disaster of epic proportions, and I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of this season, as soon as they're eliminated from the playoffs, they find a new head coach in Jamal Mosley. There's always been this weird tension all year. When you look at the quotes in the media between Paolo Banchero and Jamal Mosley, some of the moments that they've had all year where it feels like there is a disconnectedness to what is actually being done on the court versus what is being said in the locker room. And I feel like, you know, at some point you need a new voice. And ultimately, I wonder if this is the time for the Magic to find a new voice for them if they don't want to blow it up. Because there's a valid argument for this team that is now getting more expensive, has to pay Anthony Black. They are now becoming in that category of like one of the most expensive teams in the NBA. and you're fighting for your life in the play-in. So I think there's a legitimate argument to them making some big changes this summer. It will start with Jamal Mosley and the head coaching spot, but I wonder if they end up doing some other major shakeups as well, whether that's trading one of the Wagner or Paolo guys, or maybe even moving off of Jalen Suggs so that they can extend Anthony Black and kind of shift the cards that way, or shift the deck that way.
I mean, it's just tough because you gave up so many picks to get Desmond Bane, and you'd want to have all of your draft capital moving forward, especially with the new lottery odds. The new lottery odds are going to be very interesting in terms of, like, you don't have to be the worst team in basketball to end up with the number one pick anymore, no matter what shape they end up taking. So those picks, depending on how you want to look at it, might raise in value for Memphis that they got for Desmond Bane. So ultimately for the Magic, it's a tough, you know, way to look at it, considering the lack of your own draft capital. And with Franz Wagner, as much as I love the guy, I think he's a really talented player. He's the key to this team. He's the best player on this team. He hasn't played over 60 games since his third year in the league. We're in year five now, and it's been two very unhealthy seasons. And you just got to see it. He still hasn't developed the shot either. He's still a below average shooter. I thought by this point in his career, is such a high touch player from the line, a high touch player from the near the paint, near the restricted area as well, on the floater range, those little mini pull ups. I thought it would translate by now to 3-point range, but it hasn't. And so he still has a real hole in his game that needs to be resolved. I'd keep him if I'm the Magic. I'd look at everything else if I'm them. I think, first of all, I even though we joke about blow it up for the Magic, I'd think about moving Banchero first and then having a young roster without him and seeing what it can turn into. So take a step back, but not a full demolition, is the way I would go if I'm the Magic. With other East play-in teams, I am curious, as like, we got the Sixers and Magic, Sixers without Joel Embiid, just terrible. And then the Hornets and the Heat. Of those four teams, which is the most feared in the Eastern Conference?
It is undoubtedly the Charlotte Hornets. Not even close. There's nobody in here that puts fear in the 2 seed or the 1 seed in the Eastern Conference like the Hornets should. This is not a play-in team. This is only a play-in team just because of how they started the year. This is probably either the 4 or 5 seed in the Eastern Conference. And if you look at the standings, they weren't too far away from being the 5 seed in the Eastern Conference. They about like 2 games away from actually notching that. And those 2 games, by the way, it's funny because if you look at the Raptors and Hornets matchups this season, one was an Emmanuel Quickley game winner and the other was a Scotty Barnes game-winning block. If those 2 games flip the other way, the Hornets are likely hosting or at least facing the Cavaliers in round one, and that might be a little bit different of a series. But I think it's the Hornets. They are one of the best offenses in the NBA. The way that they are able to generate so many quality looks from three because of LaMelo Ball, because of Con Knipple, because of Brandon Miller, they have so many layers. Charles Lee has been an excellent coach in terms of getting the most out of this roster. And I truthfully wish that they were in the 7-8 because I would have liked to see them get even higher in the Eastern Conference. That's how good of a team they are. I would have loved to see a Celtics-Hornets series because I think that would have been ultra competitive. But it feels like we're going to get Pistons-Hornets, and I think that will be a dynamic series too, just because of the offensive questions we have for the Pistons in terms of their 3-point shooting. And then the level of offensive output that the Hornets have and how that works in a 7-game series.
I'll tell you what, though, S, that game last weekend, whatever day it was, the Detroit-Charlotte game, Detroit punched them in the mouth in the fourth quarter.
They beat
them. 3-point game. Just out-toughed them, out-hustled them, out, just beat them up, big boyed them. It was senior versus varsity. It was anything you want to call it. And this Detroit team, I mean, they came out last game of the season against the Pacers playing a lot of their starters for over 20 minutes in the game. They're not messing around against the tanking Pacers to end the year. They played like they wanted to win that game. This team is playing with an edge, a prove it mentality, even though they're the 1 seed. I've doubted them over the course of the season. I still would take the Celtics over them. in a seven-game series if that's what we end up getting in the Eastern Conference Finals. But boy, I'll tell you what, the way they played without Cade Cunningham, with Danis Jenkins taking a bigger role and Jalen Duren taking a way bigger offensive role, this team's tough, dude. I mean, like, they're going to be a major, major – I know that's an obvious thing to say about a one seed, but not always. Like, we've seen the Utah Jazz, the Atlanta Hawks, these teams where you have major questions about them. The Pistons are right there. They get a real shot to be representing the East in the finals.
They absolutely do. And I think, to your point about the physicality, it's just something that is entrenched in their identity top down. When Cade went out, they could have withered away. They could have ended up losing the one seed. But how physically and mentally tough this team is, the way they responded was incredible. And I also would say, you know, there is a lot of conversation about them being a paper tiger, just given the one seeds that we've seen, to your point, with the Hawks and the Jazz, like, flame out in the playoffs. I don't think this is that. I think this is a team that has gone through the natural progression of developing, of Cade Cunningham turning into a star, of them prioritizing certain players and enhancing what they're good at in terms of Jalen Duren being this excellent role man next to Cade Cunningham. Their connection is one of the best in the NBA, but also finding those ancillary pieces that make sense around them, whether it's Duncan Robinson as a shooter, Tobias Harris as a secondary creator. They have one of the best and most consistent identities in the NBA that will work in the playoffs. And to that point about physicality, like, you're looking at a pathway for them against the Hornets where, to your point earlier, they showed that they can be more physical than the Hornets. A very big question against the Cleveland Cavaliers, their potential second round matchup, is how the Cavs deal with physicality, how Evan Mobley deals with physicality, how Jared Allen is able to be physical against them. I also think that's a huge test for Cleveland if it ends up being Detroit versus Cleveland in the second round. Detroit, if you look at it, you know, we talked about paths earlier with the West. They have a pretty clear path to the Eastern Conference Finals. Like, there's a very clear roadmap for them to, I don't want to say walk their way into the Eastern Conference Finals, but at least comfortably compared to Boston or New York, where they have to fight against each other, get their way into the conference finals, and you're now a series away from the finals itself.
I think we're going to end up with Celtics Pistons in late May, and I think it's going to be an awesome series. I look forward to that. Let's do some playoff superlatives. I sent you some questions before the podcast as for some stuff like biggest X factor, coach on the hot seat type of things like that, player with the most approve. Who's the biggest X factor that nobody's talking about us?
Wow. I think it's Josh Hart. I think it's Josh Hart, but I kind of want to change my answer. I had Josh Hart here and we can talk about the Knicks. We're going to talk about the Knicks a little bit later in this because they're also one of my other answers. I'm going to switch my answer to Devin Vassell of the San Antonio Spurs.
Great answer.
So this is a guy who's the second highest paid player on the Spurs. Wemby hasn't hit his rookie scale max yet. And we know what we can get from Wemby. There will be obviously moments where the Spurs' lack of experience will be a factor, how they deal, how they orient themselves in clutch time moments and just deal with the adversity of a playoff series or a playoff run will be massive. But Devin Vassell has a moment to prove to everybody why he is one of their key pieces. He's obviously been huge in massive moments this season for the Spurs. You think about the NBA Cup game against the Thunder where he dropped 23. He had a massive 30-point game against the Pistons in February. He's poured in like multiple 20-plus point games against contenders in this regular season. They need him to be that. They need him in his first playoff run to be a consistent scorer, to be a consistent guy who can generate offense for them outside of De'Aaron Fox, outside of Victor Wembanyama. He needs to be a high-volume three-point shooter. He needs to get to his mid-range shot that he's very crafty at doing. And if he can do that, I think that's the difference between the Spurs being this fun, young, inexperienced team that might make it to the conference finals to this Spurs team is going to win the championship this year. I think it's that big of a difference for them.
The Spurs have so many X factors on this roster. I mean,
you can name like, seven. I agree.
Yes. Like Luke Kornet. Is Kornet going to have to play in a too big lineup next to Wemby? How much is he going to have to play? How much is Wemby going to play? Like Kornet might have to play 15, 20 minutes or share the court with him. Castle is an X factor. Carter Bryant, everybody saw the dunk the other night on Jokic, but the dude is a Swiss Army knife, defends every position, hits spot up threes. Julian Champagne, is he going to have the Julian Champagne game where he goes off and hits 8 3-pointers and wins a game for the Spurs? Dylan Harper, their rookie, who gets to the rim at will, even though he just turned 20 years old, and his last 27, 28 games, he's hitting almost half of his 3-pointers. I mean, like, they have up and down the roster beneath Victor Wembanyama, the Spurs have X factors. And that's in part what makes this team so exciting and why you feel like they have an opportunity to win the title, because it's not just Victor. It's a team full of highly talented players. I made an X factor video for Yahoo NBA on YouTube last week, where I went through all 20 playoff and play-in teams with one X factor for each. And one of the players that I highlighted was Kyle Anderson. Kyle Anderson, I'd say, is one of the biggest X factors in the postseason, because for years, what was the big issue with the Minnesota Timberwolves is what happens to the defense when you pull Rudy Gobert off the floor. You know, sometimes you pull Rudy because he's hurting your offense. Sometimes you pull Rudy because he needs a rest. Well, for Minnesota, that's been an issue for a long time with Randall and Naz Reid off the bench, leading that bench unit without Gobert. Then they had Kyle Anderson. What's been interesting is the Wolves' defense this season, in the minutes with Kyle Anderson at center, they have a 107.1 defensive rating. That with Rudy Gobert on the floor, it's 110.2. And the Wolves change the way they defend. They go from a low switch team to a heavy switch team. They switch 36% of their ball screens. And we saw against the Rockets a few weeks back when Rudy Gobert fouled out with 9 seconds left. They put in Kyle Anderson. They started switching everything. This was that epic game the Minnesota Timberwolves won. Anderson was a big part of that, with that switching defense, the blitzing, the aggressive defense. And Minnesota might have to do that, whether it's in the first round against Denver or if they advance into the second round. Kyle Anderson, an X factor nobody's talking about.
That's it definitely is an X factor nobody's talking about. I will say that, because I did not think about Kyle Anderson, but that's an incredible pull.
I mean, he's a deep cut.
Yeah, no, he's a deep cut. That's like
he's averaging like 4 points NBA. A game, plays 14, 15 minutes. He's a real deep
but
cut.
No, but it's, could be it's important. And and he's obviously like a late season addition for this team. So I think they're still working through what works and what doesn't with him. To your point about switching, I think that would be interesting in a series against the Nuggets also, like how much they're able to put Jokic or to put Kyle Anderson on Jokic and have guys help and switch off of that. It's an interesting concept. Shout out to Slow-Mo. That's a cool one. Good pull.
What's the best potential second round series not named Spurs versus Nuggets?
I kind of alluded to it earlier, but I think it will be Cavs-Pistons. I think the Cavs are going to be a very interesting matchup for Detroit because of their level of creation and shot making and three-point shooting, and it will really put a stress test on that Pistons defense. On the other side, we've talked about the Cavs and the physicality and how Mobley and Allen will either shy away or embrace the physicality of the playoffs, and I think Detroit will be a great stress test for that too. It's a litmus test for both teams. I also think that will be a long series. Like, it'll be 6 or 7 games, and it will come down to the guards of the respective teams doing the best, whether it's Cade Cunningham and how he's able to impress himself, or Donovan Mitchell and James Harden with a chance to make it to the conference finals, which is somewhere Donovan Mitchell has not been. So that's a huge series for them too.
I think on a personal level, I'm hoping for Boston, New York. Boston, New York is just always special because of the rivalry between the two cities. And I think those teams,
of course,
would really compete as well. I'd love to go to New York and see a Knicks game. I do wonder if Luka can come back healthy, if Austin Reeves can come back healthy before the second round. I'd love to actually see Lakers versus Thunder. The Thunder beat them by, 43? In the game Luka got hurt, we didn't get to see those teams compete. Maybe it wouldn't be a competition. Maybe it would end up being a sweep. But I do think the zone aspect you're talking about with the Lakers, with what that can do to the Rockets, we did see last year who took Oklahoma City to 7. It was Denver, of course, in part because of what Jokic offers offensively, but also the Nuggets played such a heavy dose of zone defense in that series. Well, the Lakers would do the same thing and try to turn the Thunder into a shooting team. I believe the numbers at the top of my head were like, you know, a third of the Thunder shots were threes against man-to-man, and then it was like 48, 49% against zone defense that the Nuggets played. So you turn them into shooting, a shooting team. I'd love to see that series for sure in the Western Conference if we end up getting that. All right, the next one. The player that'll find himself on the trade block after the playoffs.
Oh, man. So this one, I had Karl Anthony Towns of the New York Knicks. I think it's a massive postseason for the Knicks. Everything comes down to this postseason. Of course, they have a tough path ahead of them. I don't think the Hawks will be an easy series. I don't think the Celtics will be an easy series, especially with, you know, Jason Tatum back in the fold. And then in the conference finals, you'll have to play, I imagine, one of the Pistons or the Cavs. The Knicks don't have an easy way to the NBA Finals, but if they want to make it to the NBA Finals, it'll be because Karl Anthony Towns had a great playoff run. We know what we can get from Jalen Brunson. He's been a 30-point-per-game scorer the last two playoff runs for the Knicks. It feels like, come hell or high water, he's able to score 30 points in a playoff game. His game suits playoff basketball so well. But we've seen teams in the postseason really limit Cat. And his ability to beat switches in the post, to lean into the Knicks' offensive identity under Mike Brown, whether it be the creation that he's being tasked with, the dribble handoff stuff, the high post playmaking stuff that he's being asked to do, how the Knicks are able to prioritize him offensively, because there are moments and in times where you'll look up at half and Cat has taken one or two shots in the game. That can't happen in a playoff series. That can't happen against the Celtics. It definitely can't happen if you want to make it to the finals. And I think despite knowing that this is Jalen Brunson's team, the Knicks will go as far as Cat can take them. So Karl Anthony Towns, if that doesn't happen, I think the Knicks will ask a lot of questions of themselves in the summer, and those questions start with Cat.
Could it be Alperen Şengün, especially with Giannis floating out there? Doc Rivers fired. Maybe the Bucks decide to trade Giannis, or Giannis fully asks out. Maybe Houston loses in the first round and they look at their roster and they're like, well, hey, we have an opportunity to put everything on the table and go get Giannis. Could it be Şengün?
I like that. I like that as a name. I also think the Rockets shouldn't be hesitant to include Şengün in those type of deals. Like I think Şengün is a really good player.
Would you put him on the table for Giannis?
I would put one of those guys on the table.
How about Reed Sheffield
for Giannis? Yeah, I would. I think I would.
So two of the three you would put on the table.
I wouldn't be too hesitant. I know there's like injury questions with Giannis moving forward, and he's older now, and so you wonder how he adapts
get really
to
old.
A new
look. KD plus Giannis together, that's a very old team. You go from one of the youngest, ooh, we have a bright future teams, to, oh, we're one of the oldest teams in our window is 2-3 years.
Yeah. No, you accelerate the process so quickly too, because now your other complementary pieces have to compete in such a big way. And don't forget, you still have Fred VanVleet on the roster, who's in his mid-30s too, and he'll be back. And so you become old really quickly. I think if I'm the Rockets and you look at the ceiling of this group right now, do we think even if they did have Fred VanVleet this year, would they be entitled contention? I don't think they would.
No.
So then you know that this ceiling of this group is not going to get you to where you want to go anyways. You should be able to entertain a Giannis for Şengün package, or a Giannis for Amen package, or really anything that gets you in that conversation, right? Because that's where it is for Houston at this point.
The Giannis trade market is going to be so fascinating, because you talk to sources around the league. There's certain people who say, oh, it might be a tighter market than the Bucks are hoping for. He's older. He's coming off a ton of injuries. He's only got one more guaranteed year in his contract remaining. But then you talk to other sources and they say, oh, this team and that team over there, they're going to make offers. And the Bucks are going to have a very vast market. And so right now, when you kind of survey people around the league, agents, executives, it's a very mixed response when it comes to what the market might look like for Giannis. And I think it's ultimately going to come down to, do the Bucks want to grant his wishes and send him to a place that he prefers to go? Or are they going to open it up to the 29 other teams and say, make your best offer? We're taking the best offer, period. And that's where a team like Phoenix or Charlotte or whoever it might be can say, you know what, Portland, we're going to put our best offer on the table and we're going to go for it and make him be the final piece of the puzzle. Orlando with Banchero, like, who knows, right? Like, yeah. I think, you know, yeah, you know this from being in Toronto. The Raptors got Kawhi Leonard from the Spurs in part because the Spurs wanted a more proven player. They wanted DeMar DeRozan as part of that package. They didn't want the unproven Jaylen Brown from the Boston Celtics who was offered for Kawhi Leonard. And so, like, the Spurs went that route. We don't know what the Bucks want at this point. They might want a more proven player who's established rather than the collection of unknowns, draft picks, young players, and everything else. So I think the Bucks, my sense is I think they're going to open it up to every team, especially considering how ugly this relationship is ending at this point. But we'll see. It's just going to be very interesting. I can't wait to see how it unfolds.
It's bizarre to see you describe it as the more proven player in DeMar DeRozan and the unproven, we don't know what he is, Jaylen Brown, considering what Jaylen Brown is now. But just to think of how quickly everything can change for a franchise depending on what gambles they take, right? What risks they end up doing in trade talks. It's fascinating. Also, you made me think about the Charlotte Hornets as a Giannis destination, which is fascinating given their ascension in the Eastern Conference, but also the level of shooting capability that they have. It just works so well with what Giannis is good at. I would be, if I was Giannis, I think that would be the team that I would want to go play for just because of how Charlotte they Hornets. Are quickly. Yeah. I mean, can you think about him, LaMelo Ball, Con Knipple, and Brandon Miller? I know you would have to somehow maybe trade one of those guys, but the level of shooting next to Giannis would be exceptional. They would be one of the best offenses, probably one of the most unstoppable offenses in the league. We'll have months to talk about Giannis trade destinations, I'm sure. But yes, Charlotte would be really intriguing.
Who's your player with the most approve?
I'm going to say Evan Mobley. Evan Mobley of the Love Cleveland it. Cavaliers. Is
I have the same exact answer.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Perfect. Well, I mean, okay. I'm a Mobley critic.
I think it's fair to be a critic at this point because you look at that draft class, and obviously Cade has become the guy in that class. And the Pistons have taken a leap because of Cade, and he is, for all intents and purposes, the best player in that draft class. But I think some of the other guys in their class, you know, Scottie Barnes has caught up to Mobley in terms of being an all-defense level player, was getting in, like, defensive player of the year conversations earlier this year, has turned himself back into an all-star. I think there's still conversations about Şengün and how good of a player he can be, an all-star level player this year. The rest of the draft class has caught up, and I think Mobley has stagnated in a way where the offensive development isn't there, and some of the leaps that I think the Cavs expected him to take, he hasn't. And I think one of the big questions I have for him in the playoffs is ultimately, like, teams are going to dare you to shoot, especially in double big lineups. They're going to let you shoot in that corner. They're going to let you shoot above the break. I'm sure the Raptors will deploy that as a strategy as well in their first round series. Make them beat you is essentially what they're going to do with Evan Mobley. It's like, dare him to beat you offensively. That's why it's a massive series for him. Does he rise up to become the second or third best player on this Cavs team? Or does he just be who he is, which is like a very, very good defender, maybe one of the best defenders in the NBA, but at the same time, a very limited offensive player in terms of what he can do with his perimeter game. So he has huge question marks, in my opinion, in terms of how far the Cavs can go. And very similar to Karl Anthony Towns, it's like, we know what Donovan Mitchell can do in the playoffs. We know James Harden has his on and off playoff consistency, and that's a big question too. But they kind of go as far as Evan Mobley can take them. And if he lives up to his potential, then yeah, the Cavs can make the finals. They can make the Eastern Conference finals, no problem. But he's the big guy. He needs to get it done.
I think the pivot off of that, the team one bad series away from blowing it up, I'd say the Cavaliers for this answer, like non-playing teams. I'm talking of like the top six here.
Yeah.
I'd say Cleveland. Like if they lose in the first round to Toronto, you get a look in the mirror and ask yourself some serious questions if you're the Cavs front office about this roster. But also if you're Donovan Mitchell and you're like, we just lost the Raptors? Is this where I want to be for the tail end of the prime of my career? He'd have to ask some hard questions as well. And never mind the James Harden explosive aspect as well with his history of pushing his way out of destinations. I'd say Cleveland is the team with the most potential blow it up probability, especially in the Eastern Conference. Out West, Houston, not really, because they're still building. I don't think there's a team in the top six in the West that applies. It might just be Cleveland or New York, just one of those two by default. Yeah. But I don't think the Knicks are in a position to do that. But Cavs could be.
Yeah, especially because the Cavs are so expensive. Like they are paying that luxury tax. They're in the second apron. And I imagine if you do lose in the first round or even honestly the second round, I wonder if the appetite for paying that is going to decrease for ownership. Like they're just not going to want to pay that much money to invest in a team that's going to be a first or second round out. Yeah, I agree. They're definitely a blow it up team. They're also a team that I'm not sure what the solution would be if they wanted to retool. Like, of course, they could entertain Jared Allen trade offers, Evan Mobley trade offers, but what would necessarily be out there for them? Again, maybe another Giannis destination. That feels like an interesting one too. Like maybe they could do an Evan Mobley for Giannis swap, but again, we have a lot of time to think about Giannis. So,
S, thank you so much for joining me today, man. Please let people know where they can find all your stuff.
Yeah, man. Listen to the NBA Daily at The Athletic. We do that daily, as it says in the title. I cover the Raptors for Raptors Republic as well. We will obviously be covering the Raptors-Cavs series, however short and sweet that is. And yeah, appreciate you having me on as always, KOC. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Wes. Coming up next, we got Musa Diabate from the Charlotte Hornets. All right, joining me now from the Charlotte Hornets as he gets ready for Tuesday's big play-in game against the Miami Heat, Musa Diabate. Musa, how are you?
Good, and you?
I'm doing excellent today, man. You've been one of my favorite players to watch this season, really, last couple of years. Last year with Charlotte, mostly coming off the bench, and this year becoming a key starter on the team. You're one of the X factors, man. I think when people talk about the Hornets, they talk about the scoring, the three-point shooting, but not the hustle. And so I want to talk about that with you today. But first, I'm just going to say, huge play-in game on Tuesday. You guys have played Miami twice in March. Lost one of them 128-120. You won the other one 136-130. What are some lessons that you can take from those games heading into Tuesday night's matchup?
Physical team. Very physical team. One to drives in the paint. And, you know, it's just understanding that, you know, we got to stick to our principles, not get rattled. Obviously, you know, they have great players over there. And, you know, trying to do our best job to, like, you know, make the other guys play. You know, obviously, they have the two-headed snake of Bam and Tyler Hero. But there's also this understanding that, you know, they have other guys that can play, obviously. But definitely want to make the other guys, you know, beat us, if anything.
As you guys have been climbing up the standings to get into the play-in over the second half of this season, when did it start shifting playing games in Charlotte where everything started to play like a playoff game?
When everything started shifting? I have to say, like, when I felt like the atmosphere started really getting different is when we could get that first stretch. I think I want to say by, like, game six, when we won, like, six or seven games in a row, it was just like, oh, shoot. You can feel it in the air. I think it was like our 10th game when we played Detroit, or maybe the game before that, where we was just like, man, like the vibe is different. Like the way the fans is coming to the games and just like the whole atmosphere is just a whole lot different.
I mean, I think when I just remember your season, I mean, you guys at one point were 12-23 and then you just destroyed the Thunder. You beat him in early January, 124-97, and the run didn't start quite at the night of that game, but that was like one of those wow moments where it's like, okay, this Charlotte team is the bright future, and suddenly bright future became bright present when you guys started rattling off wins. What's been different over these last couple of months with the team compared to earlier in the season in your assessment?
Man, I mean, like I always say, I think, you know, it's a process, right? You can never really like fully pinpoint what exactly was the trigger. But at the same time, I genuinely feel like, you know, sometimes like this is, it's just a process thing. Like, you know, as long as you stick into the process, the results is going to happen and they're going to come. Maybe it's not going to come in the first 2 weeks, but maybe the third week, the fourth week. But, you know, at some point it's going to come. And I just think that, like, you know, it's obviously at the beginning of the year, it wasn't too great. But, you know, we just stick to the process. I think that, you know, we were really trying to own what we said we were going to do during the summer. It's been a long time work, even last year, you know. So for me, it's just the result of the work. I think that, like, you know, everything has been prepared and done from the coaching staff to us as well, to really, you know, get to a point where, like, you know, we're going to fight for this no matter what. And I just think that it really was just a process. I don't think there was a specific trigger that was like, oh, yeah, this is what happened and everything just changed. I just think that, like, you know, over time we get better, and that's all we did.
One of the things I loved about you as a draft prospect when I watched you at Michigan was your just versatility. You played with another big, you defended the perimeter, you showed flexibility, switchability, and now I look at you with the Charlotte Hornets, and that's one of your trademark qualities that makes you such a great defensive player. This season, there have been 31 bigs that have defended at least 1,000 pick and rolls, and you've switched on 30% of those screens, and that's the second most in the NBA behind Bam Adebayo, and you've also been one of the best at getting stops on those switches or even when you play drop coverage. I guess I'm just curious to kind of understand for you, is that a skill that how has it improved over time to reach the point as a starting level player? And what are some of the things that have kind of changed for you when it comes to having to do that against now the best players in the world, some of the best scorers in the world defending on the perimeter instead of like backups or college guys like in the past?
Right. I mean, I just think that like naturally, physically, I just think that like I have this this skill where like I feel like I'm just a lot more natural on the switch. I'm obviously not the biggest guy, but I definitely think that I have quick feet and pretty good hands in the sense that, like, you know, I know how to absorb contact and slap my feet. So for me, naturally, it just is something where it's like, you know, it's like use me to my strength, right? I think that that's the best way to put it. I think that coach has done a great job and understood really early from last year to just, you know, okay, that's the way that we can play with Musa. And that's what he's been done since then. And I mean, for me, it's just that's just what I've been always used to, you know, from playing one-on-one, just, you know, just getting used to it every time.
I mean, in some of these clips, your ability to fight over screens, is this something that you had to learn over time or is this something that you've always had?
I think that I naturally always was able to switch. I think that I've always naturally been quick on my feet. I just think more so like maybe like low tendencies or more so like low details, which I'm still working on. But I think that, like, you know, those little things that like makes a difference between a good defender and a great defender. I think those is the main part, like, you know, just little things from the angles, you know, not moving your feet so much, not being flat-footed, just little things like that really make a huge difference on the court that you might not really see.
And with your hustle, I mean, like in some of the clips that we looked at, like running back for chase down blocks and getting in the passing lanes, your transition game, your ability to just run the floor and hustle, is that something learned or is that something that you had like when you were a kid, when you left France to come to America?
Right. I think that's just, that's just how I am, I think. Just playing hard. I think that's the best way to put it. And over the years, you know, I've seen great examples. I think, like, you know, my rookie year, me coming in, just seeing the other players, the other guys. Obviously, I've been around a lot of Hall of Famers at that point. My second year, seeing a whole bunch of other Hall of Famers coming in and just seeing how hard they're playing and what they're telling me. You know, if you want to get on that court, you got to play hard. You got to be the hardest player playing on the court. For me, that's what it comes down to. I think that, you know, obviously you can score 30 points or anything like that. But right now, I feel like my best impact is by playing hard, and I'm just happy that it's working out.
Some of these clips we see on screen, you're jumping passing lanes. Other ones, it's a transition opportunity. You're just out hustling bigs. How do you build that conditioning to sustain that for entire games, entire seasons?
Man, that's a tough summer right there. You know, I think that like that's you know me just really like owning on it, just really making sure that you know physically. Mentally, I'm just ready to do whatever. And if that means that I have to run all day for a whole day or whatever it's going to be, run weights, whatever it got to be, I'll do it. And so for me, I think that, like, you know, I really make sure and I really try to implement conditioning my workouts a whole lot.
How old were you when you moved from France to the United States? I think you landed in Florida, right?
Yep, 14.
Wow, 14 years old. What was the conversation with your family like at the time when it came to making that decision?
They definitely looked at me crazy when I did, when I came up with it. You know, it was one of them things where, you know, I met one of my friends from the crib and I was trying to work out during the summer, and pretty much he made me make him. So he was at that point going to go to America. That was his plan. He was going to Florida. And I was just like, yo, I need somebody to work out with. So he was like, yo, look, the guy that's going to send me to the U.S. is pretty much, you know, he can work you out if you want to. He do great workouts or whatever. So I ended up working out with him. We decided to send a video or whatever. And, yeah, you know, we started getting offers. And so from that point on, it was just like, I didn't really want to do it. But then he convinced me. And then, you know, I just one day just came up to my mom and was like, yo, I just met this random guy that just wanted to send me to America. And, you know, obviously she looked at me crazy. She looked at me crazy, but it was just funny. I mean, at the end of the day, I think that, like, now we just all laugh and look back at it and we're like, man, like, it was a great decision to make.
So was it you who kind of, like, first had the thought about moving there, or was this random guy? Who was this random guy?
My man, Mo. So that's the man that's pretty much been around me since then, you know. I think that he's done a great job for me, helping me out and, you know, just guiding me through this whole process. And, yeah, I mean, he just sent a bunch of guys in America. He has, like, this academy named PBT Academy, where, like, he pretty much just develop players, young players, and send them to the U.S. And, I mean, yeah, that's what he's been doing for a very long time, even before me. So, yeah, it's just funny now, just how everything goes. And, yeah.
What was it like moving to a new country at 14 years old? What was that change like at a real formative time of your life?
Man, it's crazy. It's actually very, very, at 14 years old, I feel like it's very much a culture shock. You know, just coming into a new country, a new state, completely different weather, environment, no friends, no family around. You just got to adapt. I think that's really what it comes down to. And, you know, as a young kid, you know, you're trying to make friends, you're trying to be cool with everyone, but also you don't speak the language, so you don't want people to look at you weird. It's one of them things where you pretty much just got to go out there and, you know, you might make a fool of yourself for a little bit, but, you know, it's part of the process. And I think I've had to understand that. But over time, it definitely was hard, especially at the beginnings. First 2-3 months, I was definitely struggling for sure.
Did you speak any English at all prior to moving?
Nah, you know, it's like Americans when, like, they say I took French classes when I was younger, you know, it's like, you don't really speak French until, like, you get there, right? So it's the same with me. Like, I came in and I thought, you know, I was good until, you know, somebody spoke to me and I was like, oh, shoot, like, I really don't know nothing.
And I don't remember. I took 4 years of French. I don't remember anything at all. I remember je, tu, il, elle, nous, vous, il, elle, like I, you, he, she, we, you, they, like that's an American thing. I don't know if they actually do that in France or that's just something we learned here in America.
Same thing.
So same thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. My accent good? Je, tu, il, elle.
It wasn't. Yeah, I understood everything you said.
One of the things that I'm curious about with your game is obviously largely you're talking about your role, you're hustling, you're screening, you're finishing. There have been occasions where we kind of see you get opportunities to drive, face up opportunities, whether receiving the ball out of the short roll or when sometimes you cause a deflection or pick up a steal. And then the pump fake you had against Wemby in the Spurs Hornets game as well. Is this like a hidden development that you've kind of had in your 4 years now in the NBA where there's a bit more layers to your game than we're able to see?
For sure. I think that, you know, it's very much to the beginning. I think that people are just looking at it in the sense that, like, you know, oh, yeah, Musa need to do this and do that. But I very much will take it day by day. And for me, it's a process, right? I think that, you know, I want to get very elite at what I'm doing already before I jump into something else, right? I think very much so last year, that was my plan. Obviously, I came in as a two-way. And my mind was work hard and play as hard as you can. Okay, cool. When you did that, now let's try to establish your role, right? And so for me, it's like, okay, we got to do that again, but not at a higher level and better level, and it actually impacts into winning. So now that thank God we're doing that, I'm at that point where I'm like, okay, now let's add more into the offensive side. But I think it's very much so a process, and nothing need to be rushed. And I also need to, you know, keep on doing what I'm doing. I think that, you know, everything going to take care of itself, but I'm very much, yeah, it's coming in for sure. I think that, yeah, for sure.
You mentioned earlier how you came in as a two-way guy, spent 2 years with the Clippers, and then this is your second year with the Charlotte Hornets. For you, like, I mean, you played 33 games with the Clippers, didn't get a ton of opportunities. What do you think the Hornets saw in you with your limited opportunities there in LA? Like, what did you show in LA that now is manifesting on the court?
I think just playing hard. I think that's really what it was. I don't know if they really saw my plays from the Clippers, probably from the G League or the Summer League. But yeah, just playing hard. I think, you know, versatile defensively. I think that was the main thing, rebounding. I think very much of the things that I'm doing now. I don't think nothing was surprising in that sense. But yeah, I think that those were the main things.
Which player is the vocal leader of the team in the huddle and in the locker room?
Vocal leader? I'll say Miles Bridges and Grant Williams. I think those guys has done an incredible job into just, you know, guiding everyone, but also having this voice, you know, especially when you have a younger locker room, sometimes you need those people to talk and, you know, pretty much, you know, kind of lead the team in the right direction. And, I mean, they've done a great job. I think also Pat Connaughton is a good one as well. I feel like everybody talks, but I think those were the main three.
What's the rookie of the year case for Con Knipple?
Come on now. That's not a question. I think that, you know, he's put himself in an amazing position where he has shown that, you know, that's what he do. He's a very special player. And, I mean, I'm just excited for him. But for me, it's a no-brainer. I think he definitely is the rookie of the year.
I mean, he's unbelievable as a shooter. One of the best shooting seasons we've seen, not just for rookies, but any player in NBA history. It's crazy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now he can shoot. Now he can really shoot that thing. But also people don't realize how good his footwork is. I think, like, especially now that I'm looking at it more and more, it's like, man, like, his footwork is amazing. Like, just his base, always strong base. You know, I think that, like, that also helps so much. But that also shows a maturity to his game.
You mentioned the maturity. I interviewed Con last year before the draft, and, like, I'm 35, and I interviewed him. I'm like, oh, this dude's more mature than me. He's like a 30-year-old as an incoming rookie. Has he changed kind of the locker room at all in any way, even though he is a rookie, with his kind of mature attitude?
For sure. I think definitely by example. I think that, like, he's shown that, like, you know, he's consistent, very consistent. And I would say that for very much sure every rookie that's been in our team this year, I think they've been extremely consistent and very mature with their approach. Just, you know, from taking advice to recovery to working out, working hard. I think they've done everything to put themselves in a situation where, like, you know, you can't deny them. They've been able to play at a very early stage of their career, and I mean, that's props to them.
I mean, I think, like, the Hornets front office clearly has a type. I mean, like, adding somebody like you, adding the Duke guys, it's not just Con, but, like, Sion James is a guy who played 4 years in college as well. I mean, Liam McNeely, you know, mature young player, and Kalkbrenner as well from Creighton. It's like a lot of similar type of mindset players, hard workers. I'm sure, like, do you guys kind of like rally around that together? Is that sort of like kind of created common ground, like an atmosphere where everybody's kind of feeding off of each other's energy?
For sure. And I think there's a great balance, right? You know, like, obviously we always have fun. That's always going to be the main thing. Always have fun with it. But also this understanding that we here to work. And, you know, at the end of the day, like, we got to get the win, or we got to do what we're supposed to do. And so it's this right balance that we have where everybody trusts each other and, you know, understand what they want to do.
Do you have a funniest off-court moment with LaMelo Ball?
Funniest off-court moment. I ain't gonna lie, every day is another day. It was another funny moment with this guy. I couldn't think of one specifically right now. I have to come back to you for that because... Yeah, I can't think of something specific right now.
Well, with the Melo, the on-court fun aspect, you mentioned how that's still number one. He is undeniably still one of the funnest players in the league to watch. I can't imagine sometimes what it's like from your standpoint, being on the court or whether you're on the bench when he's on the court, watching this dude do some of the crazy stuff that he does with some of the shots he takes.
Right. No, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it's like sometimes you see him take a 30-footer and you're like, man, that's a bat. And then at the moment you better say this bad shot, he just switches in and, you know, start celebrating. You're like, oh, yeah, nah, that's, you know, that's lucky. And then you see him do it again and it's like, nah, he really do this. I mean, I think that, you know, his game is very much identical to how he is as a person, you know. Joyful, just play with no stress. I think that, like, he understands his game, but he also understands who he is as a person. And that's the confidence that we need him to be at all times. So, I mean, I'm very grateful for him. And, yeah, you know, it's definitely fun to play with him.
Well, Moose, I'm really rooting for you guys this week. I want to see the Hornets in the playoffs this weekend. Good luck in the play-in Tuesday against the Miami Heat, and then another one later this week, a to-be-determined opponent. Moose, thank you so much for joining me today, man.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
Big thank you to S. Barahini and Musa Diabate for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Emmy and the whole team for producing today's show. We'll be back again later in the week at Tom Haverstraw on Thursday, live on YouTube. Also got another interview coming on Wednesday with somebody I'm very excited to have on the show. And we're going to be previewing the NBA playoffs. Going to reveal my full awards ballot as well. We still don't know. Is Luka eligible? Is Cade Cunningham eligible? More to find out. More award talk. More playoff talk. More draft talk. It's best time of the year. NBA playoffs starting up. Have a good week, everybody.